the topic tonight is the roots of suffering. And one of the most common works of art in Tibet is something like this. It's a circle with circles within it, being held by what looks like a monster, but he's actually this very powerful being who, after going in the wrong direction for a while, ended up becoming the protector of Buddhism on Earth. And like stained glass windows and sculpture in a church, this bit of iconography, and it's very complex, it's very dense, but it's a teaching aid for a pre-literate people, so that by looking at what's depicted in each of these sections, you can get a really good overview of the Dharma, and particularly this whole problem that we have as human beings with suffering. And I don't mean bad luck. I mean the way we respond to events that makes us unhappy. And I don't mean to imply that we choose to be unhappy. That's not it at all. But it is possible that regardless of what's going on around us, we can be at peace. We don't have to be in misery. So this kind of suffering that I'm talking about, I really like to use the Pali term, which is dukkha. And it's a lot like it sounds. Dukkha. It's not something you really want to have around. And it has roots, which is what the very center, in fact, this whole depiction is about, that the very center has three beings in it. And one of them is almost always a snake. Not in this picture, but in many of them, out of the snake's mouth comes the other two animals. The snake is ignorance. And those other two animals are greed and hatred. And those are usually considered the roots of dukkha. Ignorance being the central root that gives rise to the other two. So what is it ignorance of? Well, it's ignorance of the basic teachings of Buddhism. Number one of which is that the idea of our having a self that's separate from the rest of phenomena is an illusion. So the ignorance here is of our true nature. And Buddha was asked over and over, well, what is our true nature? If we're not the self that we think we are, what are we? And he never answered it. He would just go through the list of what we aren't. It's a much more valuable experience to discover that on our own, each of us for ourselves. Usually that's done through meditation. And what Buddha did was he sat down and he said, I'm going to look for myself. And he determined that there was nothing that he could find that met what he had thought was the definition of himself. It's just not in there. It's a bad assumption that we've made, which isn't to say that we don't have a self in the psychoanalytic sense, but it's an idea, and it's a very helpful idea, but that's all. This is the wheel of life, also called the wheel of becoming, and about 16 years ago, I took a course on difficult emotion, taught by one of the very early Zen teachers in the area, named Yvonne Rand. And she used this device, this wheel of life, to illustrate the teachings. She emphasized, and I would like to emphasize, the outer rim of the wheel, where there are 12 icons that demonstrate the whole cycle of cause and effect that leads to reincarnation. I'm not a believer or a disbeliever in just about anything, but very few people really accept this as an explanation of what happens after the body dies, here in the Western world, that is. At the time of Buddha's life, that's what people believed. And in my investigation, it's very difficult to change this narrative after it's learned in early childhood. There's just sort of a presumption that whatever we learned early on is going to happen to us after the body dies is pretty much what it is. So letting go of any of it is a bit of a challenge. Buddha didn't. That's what he taught, was reincarnation. So I like to skip to number 7 and kind of stop at 9, because these are the steps in the process that explain the way that dukkha comes into our lives in a way that most of us are comfortable with. Most of us get it. The ones 1 through 6 have to do with the formation of the body, the fact that the senses can perceive things, start to make sense of what it is, begin to identify things. And then when we get to number 7 and we're able to perceive the world around us, what happens is something totally automatic. We can't make it stop without being fully enlightened. And even then, maybe not, but it's going to happen. And that is the arising of a response to our experience that is either pleasure, displeasure, or neutral. It's called Vedana in Pali. A lot of people feel like if they can't get around this liking or not liking things, then the fact that they suffer is their fault. They feel guilty about their preferences. In the great article that I found and excerpted into that PDF, it was made clear that it can't be your fault. Guilt is absolutely unjustified when it comes to Vedana, because you have no control over it. You will respond by either liking or not liking things. What happens after that? There's still no sense in feeling guilty about it. That's just going to add more dukkha to the pile. But if we are completely unaware of our preferences, then Vedana will grow and it will develop more power over our lives. The next phase on that outer rim is craving. number 8, and the Pali word is tanha. It's not just a set step, it's also a spectrum. And craving can exist in a weak form or an extreme form. Sort of the emblematic example of craving is addiction. That's kind of extreme. You know, particularly someone who is homeless and unable ever to be clean from the substance. You know, a really strong addiction can take a while to develop. And craving is like that. In a normal, not terribly dukkha-producing form, it's an appetite or just a strong preference. And it can take the form of desire. I really want that. I'm jonesing after some coffee. Or stronger than that, lust. Or sort of a middle range, doesn't go away, yearning. Buddha often used the word that is very directly translatable into the word thirst. It's compelling when there's that feeling of thirst, the desire to drink is almost irresistible. It's a spectrum, and it continues to grow stronger and stronger. When these appetites are frustrated, they produce anger, grief, a sense of loss. Even if we never got that desire satisfied, we can live in fear of that obstruction. Craving doesn't just mean desire, it also means what we often think of as aversion. Any kind of dislike. When we feed our cravings, they turn into clinging. We are clinging when we are slaves to our passion. And this is where you see the addict in the gutter. There are 4 aspects to clinging, and they're closely related to the very first level of enlightenment. A craving for sense pleasure. That can be anything from food to aesthetic pleasure to sexual pleasure, the high that skiers get, whatever. It's a pleasure that comes from interacting with the physical world, related to the senses. I like the way one writer put this, clinging to evil views. Racism of any form, the ideologies that cause people to bully other people, oppress, exterminate, go out into the extremes behind these evil views. And then this one might surprise you, and that is a clinging to rituals. And the reason why this is a serious form of clinging is it's magical thinking. A lot of ancient religions were based on the idea if they just sacrificed the chicken in the right way, then the crops would come in and the rains would come on time and beautiful, healthy babies would be born and life would be good. And that totally distracts us from the fact that happiness is an inside job and we can't manipulate good fortune through rituals. A lot of people enjoy rituals as kind of acting out ideas, very similar to the way this picture has icons for ideas. And so that's a different thing. Dancing under the full moon or whatever but believing in them as having magical efficacy really sends us in the wrong direction. And finally, of course, clinging to the view of self, the idea of who I am, and lifting that up as one of the most important things in life. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, I do that. And I'd be happy to confide with you that I do too. I don't like to say how well things are going because the other shoe is going to drop faster because I've said it. Of course I fall back on the idea of self because it's so pervasive. You can't speak English without it. I, you. It's how we construct our sentences. Being free of these forms of clinging or craving is something that takes a practice that is ongoing. And I don't know if there's any time when we can be completely free of them, but we can keep them to a dull roar a lot of the time. And there comes a point in our practice, it's called entering the stream. Is that a familiar term for anyone? It's the first stage of enlightenment. And it's the point at which, usually in intense meditation, there's a breakthrough that happens that's clearly recognizable as a breakthrough. Some of these forms of clinging are just gone. The belief in the ritual, the rock-solid belief that the self exists as an independent entity, they just let go. But there are several stages of enlightenment after that. So it is a process. The mind states of suffering are represented in this middle wheel. And they depict states of mind that we're probably all familiar with. The first one is the realm of the gods, or the devas. And this is where everybody is happy, everything is lovely, people are sitting around in the shade playing music, having picnics. But off in the corner, they're going to war against their next door neighbors. And the thing is, it is so lovely that they see no reason whatsoever to practice. And so eventually that ends and they're right back into suffering. Some people say that's a vacation. It could just be a lovely period of time when everything's going your way. That's the deva realm. You don't feel like meditating. You're completely at peace. So it's not completely mythological. And you may know people who, for their entire lives, are like this. Or hear of them. I often think of the super rich as devas. Or, well, I hate to call them gods, but, you know, they're living in that realm where everything is posh. The next mind state is the titans, those people that the devas were going to war for. The titans remind me of the capitalist businessmen. They've got wealth, power, all sorts of things going for them, and all they want is more. And they'll take it from the devas. Almost always there's a tree between those two realms. Part of it's in the deva realm, and part of it's hanging over into the titan realm, and you see the titans trying to steal the fruit. The third realm is the hungry ghosts. And these are these cartoon characters with really skinny throats and distended bellies, like, you know, like starving children. Because their throats are so tiny, they can't swallow anything. So they're always wanting to eat, but they never can. They're always hungry. They cannot be satisfied. They're caught in a state of always wanting and not having. I think I go through this one about four times a day. There are a number of things that I've always wanted, and they'll cross my mind from time to time, and I'm right back in to the world of the hungry ghost. Oh, I still haven't gotten that. It's still on the bucket list. Or I think of something new to want, and I can't get it. It's not a pleasant frame of mind. It's not a pleasant existence. But the next one sounds a whole lot worse, and it is. It's the hell realm. And it's marked by anger, terror, and claustrophobia. I've been there. I've been scared. I was really, really scared about 6 weeks ago when my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I went into, you know, warrior mode and dealt. And fortunately, it was something that it could be dealt with, and it has been. A number of doctors have told her, if you're going to get it, this is the kind to get. So I feel very, very fortunate. But I was in an hell realm for a while. People who are in a hell realm can be angry and abusive, or cold, or feeling really isolated. Is any of this ringing bells for you? And because of that isolation, because this suffering is so intense, we don't have outlets. We don't have comfort from other beings. So all of that anger can become self-abusive. And I've seen this happen. I have chronic pain, and particularly when I'm having a really bad spell, I begin to wonder if life is worth living. And, oh, poor, pitiful me. It just starts piling it on. So are you beginning to see that these realms are not just myth, but they're part of our daily lives? And their manifestation of some level of craving or clinging. Some distance from Vedana that is so great that we're really feeling it. We're really living in it. Which brings me to the next part of that central wheel, which is the human realm. Because this is where we can get out. We can get off the wheel. This is where we have enough questioning and curiosity to notice that we're suffering. And to understand that we don't want to. We have passions, certainly. But because the Dharma is readily available to us, we can use it to reduce the power of clinging or craving in our minds at the moment or throughout our lifetimes. On almost every wheel of life, in the left corner, there's a little Buddha. Sometimes it's just represented as some form of light, but it's there. It's always there. And those of us who are fortunate enough to have access can always use it to escape from the roots of suffering. most of my Dharma talks are about that. How to use the practice and the Dharma to untangle ourselves from clinging and craving. And the first is always to notice that we're suffering and how it is that we're clinging or craving. I guess to end, I want to just make note that a really good companion practice, whether we're going for the very root of ignorance in intensive meditation, or just daily life practice of noticing, oh, I'm in a hell realm again. How can I get out of this? A great companion practice is metta. And now that we've reviewed the roots of suffering and these realms that they put us into, perhaps you'll see a little more meaning in wishing all beings, including ourselves, to be free from ignorance, greed, and hatred. Because any one of us, any sentient being who's freed from these roots of suffering, make life easier for all of the rest of the beings on Earth. Because Titans are really unpleasant neighbors, and we've all got one, and we take our turn being one. So please join me. Just take a moment and come back to being here now, and join me in wishing, may all beings be free from ignorance. May all beings be free from greed. May all beings be free from hatred. May we all know our true nature. Thank you.